This is David Wolford, and I'm with Bob Sedler, Professor Bob Sedler, an attorney currently teaching at Wayne State University. I'm interviewing Mr. Sedler largely for his involvement in the desegregation suits in Kentucky in the early 70s. Mr. Sedler, how are you?
We're fine, thank you.
If you would just give us a little introduction about yourself, where you grew up and how, you know, your life up through law school, perhaps?
I grew up in Pittsburgh. I was born in 1935. I went to college and law school at the University of Pittsburgh. I graduated in 1959, spent two years at Rutgers Law School in New York. My first full-time teaching job was at St. Louis University, beginning in 1961, and in the 1962-1963 year, I litigated with the lawyers from the NAACP a successful challenge to school segregation in the Charleston School District in the Missouri Boot Hill, that's south east of Missouri, jutting into Arkansas, aptly named Mississippi County. From 1963 to 1966, my wife and I were in Ethiopia. I went there under the auspices of the Ford Foundation to help found a new law school in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. I came to the University of Kentucky in 1966, and I was on the faculty of the law school there until 1977. I did a great deal of public interest litigation while I was in Kentucky. I was the general counsel for the ACLU of Kentucky from 1971 to 76, and during that time, the ACLU of Kentucky was the principal organization litigating the school desegregation cases in Lexington, Fayette County, and Louisville, Jefferson County. I was the lead attorney in both cases. I went on a sort of a two-year leave beginning in the fall of 1975 that had been planned in advance. Ironically, this was the time of implementation of the Louisville Jefferson County desegregation plan, and I wasn't there, leaving everything to Tom Hogan and the other lawyers in Louisville. And I did not come back to the University of Kentucky. I took this position at Wayne State in 1977, and I continue to be here today. My official title is Distinguished Professor of Law. I teach the courses in constitutional law. I've done a lot of pro bono litigation for the ACLU of Michigan and elsewhere, but I've kind of retired from active litigation when I hit 70.
Okay. You talked about litigating with the NAACP in the mid-60s. Can you tell me who are some of the people you worked with or what that experience was like?
Well, this was in St. Louis, Missouri. Interestingly enough, the principal lawyer for the NAACP, a person named Clyde Cahill, was then in his early 40s. I was, I think, 26 or something at that time, I guess, yeah, 26, 27. And he eventually became the United States District Judge. He just died last year. And he was the principal lawyer. He was the litigator. I supplied a lot of the constitutional doctrine. And this involved the Charleston, Missouri School District. It was a southern district, of course, and it never did not desegregate the schools following the Brown decision. And it maintained two separate high schools, Charleston for whites and Lincoln for African Americans. And, you know, they said, we need more delay, we need more delay. And our position was, you don't need any more delay. This is a small area in 1962, and you're capable of desegregating all of the schools immediately. And the federal judge, who was from that area, agreed and ordered a desegregation plan that went into effect in the fall of 1963. And again, I was off to Ethiopia, so I did not actually see its implementation, but I know that it went into effect.
Was the attorney Clay Hill, was he a local NAACP, yeah, or was he out of New York?
No. He was a local lawyer. You know, in those days, there weren't very many African-American lawyers throughout the South. Now, there were more in a place like St. Louis, but, you know, there weren't very many in Kentucky either. We estimated, you know, circa 1971, when we filed these cases, that in the entire state of Kentucky, there were maybe no more than 20 African-American lawyers in varying degrees of practice. So there weren't very many African-American lawyers, and in those days, in the early 60s, a lot of assistance was provided by the National Office of the NAACP. In any event, but Clyde and I litigated the case pretty much on our own. As I say, I provided the constitutional background and Clyde provided the lawyering skills. You can imagine that we caused a lot of stir, one black guy, one white guy working together, and this will be interesting to you, hard for my students and others to believe. The federal court was in Cape Girardeau, Missouri. In 1963, which was before the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964, Clyde and I could not have stayed together in a hotel in Cape Girardeau. A point of fact, we stayed in the black community in Charleston, Missouri. It was a small house that was made available for us, and we later found out that the local community had posted guards around the house because of the fear of violence. Also, it may be noted that all of our plaintiffs in the school case were mothers and daughters. And that was because it was not part of the culture of Southeast Missouri to do violence against African-American women and girls. But it was part of their culture to do violence against African-American men and boys. Again, this is very hard to believe 40 years later. One of the advantages of growing old is that what for other people is history was for you a contemporary event.
Yeah, that is an interesting strategy that you took there. It sounds like that case was a violation of de jure de jure segregation.
Yes, that was an easy case. But see, again, you have to remember that the same thing was true in Louisville. The Louisville School Board did a little bit of desegregation in 1955, and it was a company who wasn't any violence, and it was praised by President Eisenhower and all that. But actually, it was very little actual desegregation. And Jefferson County, of course, did not desegregate its one 8th grade African American school, which was Newburgh. So again, the pattern in Louisville and Jefferson County was similar. In Lexington, by the time we brought our case in 1971, the school board had desegregated the high schools. They took the former black high school, Dunbar, and they made it a junior high school right next to Lexington High School. So you had this strange phenomenon in central Lexington of two junior high schools, Lexington and Dunbar, right next to each other. It's only understandable that one was the former black high school and one was the former white high school. But there was very little in the way of desegregation of the elementary and junior high school. So in truth, throughout the South, unless and until there were legal actions, there was little or no desegregation. If that was true in the early 60s in Charleston, Missouri, it was true a decade later when I was in Kentucky.
All right. Now, did you have much contact with Jack Greenberg, or was this...
I met Jack Greenberg and Margaret Wilson, who was the president of the National NAACP in 1963, I think when they came to St. Louis for a fundraiser, or it may have been actually to Charleston. So I did meet them once, correct.
Okay. And what caused you to take up these cases? This case out of Missouri sounds like it's one of your first major cases anyway.
Well, it was. Anyway. I say I was 26, 27.
What caused you to get connected with the NAACP, and what caused you to want to pursue this?
When I graduated law school and I knew I was going into teaching, I wasn't going to practice. I wanted to get some real-world experience, but I also wanted to do something about civil rights. Remember, I went to college and law school in the end of the McCarthy period, the Cold War era. The Brown case was decided in 1954 when I was in college. So when I moved to St. Louis, I knew somebody that put me in touch with the local people for the NAACP. And I also got in touch with someone from the ACLU, but I definitely wanted to do this. I'd always wanted to do public interest litigation, and I did some other things when I was in St. Louis. I did some testimony before the legislature on the one person, one vote. I did a TV show on the House of calling for the abolition of the House on American Activities Committee, which prompted a prominent alumnus of St. Louis University to send a letter to the president demanding that they repudiate me. And then, as I say, there was this opportunity to go abroad, and we did it. We didn't know it was going to last for 3 years, but it did. And then when I came back to Kentucky in 1966, this is the heart of the civil rights struggle. The first thing that I did there in Kentucky was I'd been contacted to work on a fair housing law that was being proposed for Lexington and Fayette County in the spring of 1967. Then when that passed, I was known to the people for the ACLU and the NAACP. Remember, it was a pretty small liberal group in Kentucky in the middle and late 1960s, and it wasn't difficult to get started.
All right, let's go to some of the Kentucky suits that you were involved in. Generally speaking, did the plaintiffs approach you, or did you approach the plaintiffs?
Robert Jefferson was the lead plaintiff in the Lexington case, and as I say, he's the one that initiated. He was the other person was Glenn Pritchett. They were both on the Lexington Human Rights Commission, and to the best of my recollection, they approached us. Us meaning the people in ACLU, and I looked at the case and we talked about it, and we said, we can do it. But I want to emphasize that both Jefferson and Glenn Pritchett did an awful lot of work on the case in putting together the facts.
To what degree did the Kentucky Civil Liberties Union, or really the national ACLU, get involved in this kind of thing?
Basically not at all.
So this was just the Kentucky Civil Liberties Union was operating, they had this agenda more so than the national organization?
On a national basis, the NAACP, which by that time had split into the NAACP and the Legal Defense and Education Fund, were doing the school desegregation cases. One of the reasons that the Kentucky ACLU took a leading role is that the NAA was not that strong in Kentucky at that time. Remember, as I said, that in the whole state there were perhaps 20 African American lawyers. So it was sort of, we did it by default, so to speak, although we worked closely with the NAACP in Louisville. But there really wasn't much of an NAAC presence in Lexington at that time. That's hard to believe today, but we're talking about 30-plus years ago.
Did you ever contact the national NAACP for these two cases, the Lexington and Louisville suits?
No.
Okay.
As I say, we did it ourselves. You know, that's another thing, too. I mean, litigation has changed very much. Now you have the, you know, national ACLU, the NAACP, LDEF, you have the National Organization of Women. They raise a lot of money. They have full-time lawyers, large affiliates, have legal counsel, legal directors, as well as executive directors. In 1972, the Kentucky Civil Liberties Union had one part-time secretary in Louisville. That was the sum total of the strike. All of the lawyers were volunteers. Later, they got an executive director. But again, all of the lawyers were volunteers. There were certain kinds of cases that we got some advice from the national people. I remember doing that when I was litigating the first gender discrimination cases. But for the most part, we did it ourselves.
Okay. Was the KCLU pretty much unanimous on doing these two cases? Was there ever kind of a vote amongst the state board?
There was never an issue about the Lexington Fayette case because there was no countervailing force. The Louisville case was a difficult one politically because Newman Walker was the superintendent of Louisville. They had a very strong commitment to quality education for African-American children. There was a good staff. The parents were getting involved. And basically, the position of the Louisville board was that if we go for desegregation, we're going to lose the whites. And if the plaintiffs win and we're merged with Jefferson County, we're not going to be able to do the good things that we've been doing for African-American children. Now, the contrary view was that segregation is segregation, that our children are not doing well in school despite your best efforts, and that everybody will be better off if we have desegregation. So there was that kind of split within the black community in Louisville, which was pretty well organized in the early 1970s. And this was reflected in an ACLU. We made a strategy decision that we weren't going to seek a merger, that what we wanted was cross-busing between Louisville and what we called the annexation area. The city of Louisville had annexed portions of near-in Jefferson County, but school districts were separate. So you had part of the city of Louisville that was in Jefferson County.
Jefferson County School District.
So that was our suit. Now the Kentucky Commission, and we in the NAA were together in that part of the suit. We had filed an earlier suit against Jefferson County to desegregate Newburgh and Cane Run and Schaefer, schools that were that had become predominantly black schools. Now, the Kentucky Commission on Civil Rights, under the leadership of Galen Martin and with their lawyer, Tom Hogan, who you know, Tom passed away almost 20 years ago, disagreed with that view, and they intervened seeking countywide desegregation.
By merger, right?
By merger. So, but we were on the same side, of course, because first we had to win desegregation and then we had to win crossing school district lines. But by the time we won that, now we're talking about 1974, we were all agreed that the only feasible way was countywide desegregation and a merged district. So, but yes, there was that kind of disagreement.
It sounds like the only reason you didn't go for merger, or the primary reason, is that you felt the Jefferson County School Board's philosophy would take over and remove some of the good things that Newman Walker and the city board were doing.
That was the concern.
Yeah.
That was, now again, my own view was, I did not agree with them. My own view was that we eventually were going to have merger in any event, and we did have to have merger in any event.
Okay. Going back just before you filed these, the two Supreme Court decisions, Green versus New Kent, Virginia, that was 1968, I believe, and
right.
Swan versus Charlotte Mecklenburg, 1971, that was
correct,
in North Carolina. Those two set precedents that put a little bit more obligation or responsibility on school boards to actually see to it that effective and substantial integration was happening.
Excuse me, yes.
Now, let me just ask you this. When that was going on, where were you, and were you watching to, you know, were you kind of waiting in the wings on that decision?
Well, they both had a different impact. Yes, we were watching it very closely. As soon as Green came down in 1968, that made it clear that we could win in Lexington, Fayette County, and we could win against Jefferson County, because Green said that it was necessary to desegregate the schools. You couldn't use freedom of choice. You had to take affirmative efforts to do it. And so that Green was the basis of Jefferson County and Fayette, both of which were filed in 1971. Now, after they had been filed, but concurrently, the Swan decision came down, and Swan said this includes busing. So Swan made it very feasible to try to seek cross-district busing. In the meantime, the Detroit case had been around since 1970.
That's Milliken versus Bradley,
Milliken,
right?
Milliken versus Bradley. It had reached the Sixth Circuit before our case, and the Sixth Circuit said that cross-district busing may be appropriate in some circumstances. So once we, as you know, Judge Gordon originally ruled against us in both of our cases, and it wasn't, and when we won those cases on appeal in the Sixth Circuit in December 1973, the Sixth Circuit had already decided Detroit, and so the case was sent back to Judge Gordon with directions to achieve full desegregation, including, if necessary, by cross-district busing.
And then I think a plan was being formulated, and then before it could be put into action, the Supreme Court ruled that overruled the Sixth Circuit on the Milliken case.
The plan had been put into effect in July of 1974. We just had a long hearing. The judge finally set up his own plan. It was comprehensive desegregation.
Cross district, but leave the two districts in separate entities still.
I think that was part of the original plan. I don't remember, because it wasn't too important, because there was going to be supervision in any event. In any event, the plan lasted exactly 2 days, because the Supreme Court ruled in Detroit that cross-district busing was not permissible in Detroit, that then they vacated the Sixth Circuit decision, and they sent the case back to Sixth Circuit. I remember that the Louisville Board celebrated by giving the employees the rest of the day off. There were big headlines in the Louisville Courier-Journal that day in July in 1974, and certainly it looked as if there were still going to be separate. There's going to be desegregation, but probably in the view of the local media, you can check the stories at that time, that probably meant there was going to be no cross-district busing in Louisville and Jefferson County.
The celebration was because why?
because the Supreme Court vacated the decision.
But this was the Louisville board and staff celebrating.
Correct, because the Louisville board feared correctly that if there was cross-district busing, that would eventually be the end of the separate Louisville district.
So why would they celebrate something that they thought was going to be bad?
No. If there was no cross-district busing, the Louisville district would survive.
Oh, I see. But didn't the same group also want effective integration in reality?
The Louisville board, and when I say the board, I mean the staff.
Administration.
I don't speak for everyone, but they were very ambivalent about it. Yes, they favored desegregation, but they also wanted to maintain what they considered to be quality education and community involvement. I have the highest respect for all the people on the board, Louisville board, and for Newman Walker and his staff. I know one of the people, I haven't met him, although is Frank Rapley, who had been the superintendent of Kalamazoo here in Michigan. I don't know if you've met him in your interviews.
No, I haven't.
But he was the person who did the major work on formulating the plan. The people in the Louisville board feared correctly that if there was a desegregation plan limited to Louisville only, there would be white flight, and the Louisville district would become blacker and poorer. So when push came to shove, they opted for continued separate existence, and they weren't too concerned about desegregation.
Okay. During this time and before these suits, did you have much contact with the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare?
I did not. Now, Galen Martin and the staff on the Kentucky Commission on Human Rights did.
Okay. Can you describe the federal judges that you tried the cases before?
Yes. There were two very, very interesting people. Let me take Louisville and let me take Fayette County first. This was Max Swinford. Now, if you were typecasting, if Hollywood were typecasting for a federal judge, they would pick Max Swinford. He was tall, aristocratic, and by the time we had the case, white-haired. In those days, there were two federal district judges for the Eastern District of Kentucky. The senior one sat in Lexington. The other judge literally rode circuit among all the different federal courthouses in the Eastern District of Kentucky. And so Max Swinford started out as the junior judge, and he was known in Eastern Kentucky as the law. By the time that I came to him, by the time he was now in Lexington, he was conservative. But he was fair, and on issues of race, he strongly believed that segregation was wrong. And he was very sympathetic to our case. We had another case before him earlier involving the Kentucky High School Athletic Association. You may be familiar with that. During the Brown days, there was a separate league called the Kentucky High School Athletic League for the quote colored schools, and there was the Kentucky High School Athletic Association for the white schools. After Brown, they abolished the Kentucky High School Athletic League, but they told the officials, your certification doesn't count anymore, you have to start all over again. And in those days, the high school coaches chose the officials. Well, as you know, high school basketball is very big in Kentucky. And in the spring of 1971, I think it was Anderson County, all white, played one of the Louisville high schools, all black. And the white officials made some bad calls against, I think it was Louisville. It was either Mail or Central, I don't know which one. And this put in some pressure to get some black, some more athletic officials who were black, and some black members on the board of the Kentucky High School Athletic Association. They refused. We brought suit in federal court in Lexington because we wanted Judge Swinford. He found illegal segregation. He ordered them to certify all of the black officials who had been certified prior to Brown. He changed the method of selecting them, and he even ordered them to hire an assistant commissioner. So Max Swinford was a judge that was very sympathetic to desegregation. Now, James Gordon, by the way, Swinford was a Democrat. Those are days when Kentucky was a Democratic state.
Let me before you start talking about Gordon, which I am interested in, let me give you just a couple questions on the High School Athletic Association suit, okay?
Okay.
Hang on just a second. All right, if it's okay, I would, Mr. Sedler, I'd like to just have you elaborate a little bit more on the High School Athletic Association suit. Who were the plaintiffs in that case, and how did that...
That came from, it came from Louisville. The plaintiff's name was Alston, who was an official in the Kentucky High School Athletic League who had never been certified. As I said, it grew out of this bad call. There was a Louisville Human Rights Commission. There was a reverend, was a rabbi named Martin Purley was his name, and he led this movement to, you know, ask the Kentucky High School Athletic Association to change its rules and to have some black members on the board. They say no, those are the rules, and so they were motivated. They brought the suit. Now remember, this is at a time when the Louisville schools were all black, the high schools, and they had pretty good basketball teams. Now, it's a very much a traditional African-American sport that we see reflected today in the NBA.
Right.
So that was a very important issue. Of course, one of the things that desegregation did was to take a number of the African-American players at high school, manual and male, and shift them to county schools. It equalized things. I suspect that the coaches who were very happy with me then, I'm sorry, you know, the black coaches weren't so happy after those teams were broken up and they no longer had any kind of advantage.
Right, right. I read an article that came, excuse me, out of the, I think Graves was the Louisville Central coach, and when the busing order came, only two of his, he was going to have 10 returning players, and only two were able to actually return.
Right.
So I don't know his win-loss record that next year, but I'm sure it wasn't so good.
It equalized things.
Yeah. So this movement came out of Louisville. You know, how did you plan for this kind of suit?
When we would be approached for, that's a good question, when we would be approached for a suit, you had to have a theory. Now, again, the theory of the referee's case was that the Kentucky High School Athletic Association had an affirmative duty to integrate the Kentucky High School Athletic League into the association, and that the state failed in its duty. It's very much like the Green case with respect to schools. So you develop a theory, and Judge Swinford agreed with us on the fact and ordered the remedy. Sweeping remedy, they added two African-American members to the Board of Control, they hired an assistant commissioner, they affirmatively recruited African-American officials. Litigation can change the world.
It sounds like it was just a statistical argument. That case, it was so easy for you to prove. I think it was something like 1%.
They had maybe 25 in various forms. But again, the point is, it wasn't a matter of the fact. There had to be a legal theory, And the theory was an affirmative duty to overcome state-imposed segregation at all levels, which was recognized by the court in the Green decision and given further impetus in Swan. If I remember, Swan came down that June, and we filed the Kentucky High School Athletic Association suit that summer. But I know that Swan had been decided when we filed the suit.
All right, so you were starting to talk about Judge Gordon.
Judge Gordon was interesting. I first met him in the court in August of 1967. Now, Gordon was a Johnson appointee. Swinford had been appointed by Roosevelt. Gordon had just been appointed to the federal court. In those days, constitutional challenges to state laws were heard by three federal judges. Anyhow, this case arose in eastern Kentucky. In the summer of 1967, there was the SCEF. These were Carl and Ann Braden, who had workers in eastern Kentucky, and Joe Malloy, who, as you know, was one of my clients in a draft case to go to the Supreme Court, was working with the Appalachian Volunteers. They were working against strip mining. And the strip miners got the local prosecutor, also was a coal mine owner, to have a midnight raid against the McShirleys, against Joe Malloy. They indicted them. They indicted Carl and Ann Braden on a charge of teaching sedition, saying they were going to try to overthrow the government of Pike County, Kentucky, and set up a communist government. I know it sounds strange.
This is 67.
4 years later, but it wasn't so strange in 1967, that summer. In any event, the Southern Conference Educational Fund was represented by famous lawyer Bill Kunstler, who filed a federal court suit to have this sedition law declared unconstitutional and the prosecutions enjoined. Judge Gordon was one of the judges on the panel, along with Judge Moynihan, who was the other judge in the Eastern District of Kentucky, and former Kentucky Governor Burt Combs, who was at that time a judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. Now, remember, had only been at Kentucky a year, and I was coming off the work on the fair housing law, and then I was asked to be the lawyer for the Kentucky Civil Liberties Union, which intervened in the case as a friend of the court. Well, Gordon came across to us as very liberal. He was outraged by what he saw. He said that the law is unconstitutional, and he and Combs made up a majority. They struck the law down and enjoined the prosecutions. Then I met Judge Gordon again. You know, there weren't many judges in those days. There were only two in the Eastern District and two in the Western District. And I was doing draft defense, including Joe Malloy, who was one of the people who was one of the Appalachian Volunteers. Well, Judge Gordon was not very sympathetic to draft resisters. Very unsympathetic. He did not buy any claims of conscientious objection or unfair treatment by the board, and he found Malloy and another person I was representing guilty, gave them the maximum 5 years in jail. I eventually won the Malloy case in the United States Supreme Court in 1970. So by this time, Judge Gordon had come across to me as a pretty conservative judge. He was a fair judge. He was open-minded. And you know, most of the cases that I had before him, I lost. He would say, "Professor Sedler, I call them the way I see them. If you don't agree with me, there's a federal court of appeals in Cincinnati, and you can go there." And so when we drew Judge Gordon as the judge in the Louisville case, we assumed that he was not going to be sympathetic, because he did not want to see a merger. As you know, he ruled against us. But once the Sixth Circuit ruled in our favor, as he was fond of saying, he got his marching orders. And he was determined to have that desegregation plan work, and it did. I saw Judge Gordon after he had retired in 1984, was in Louisville for some other proceedings later in the case, and went over to visit him in his home. And as you know, he had a very nice obituary in the New York Times. And I had written a letter to Mrs. Gordon. He was a wonderful federal judge. He said he had his marching orders, and he saw to it that the plan was going to be implemented. He's just a conservative judge. He did not really agree with the lawsuit, but once we won him on the merits, then he was determined to see that the plan was going to be successful.
Now, I'm just kind of fact-checking here. You may or may not know these answers, but was he, Lyndon Johnson, was he the campaign manager for Kentucky in 64?
I don't know. I know that he was from Owensboro. I don't know what, because I wasn't in Kentucky in 64, so I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. What was it, you know, how did he run a courtroom? Well, wait a minute. The other question I wanted to ask you, I'd read somewhere that he got two offers to be appointed to the Sixth Circuit and turn them down. Do you know if there's any truth to that?
I do not know that. I've never heard that rumor. It is possible.
Okay. So what was it like in his courtroom?
It was the way you would expect it to be in a federal courtroom. A marshal would call order. The judge was there. He was very genial. He let the lawyers try their own cases. For one time when I had the draft case and I was arguing that the jury was made up only of white males, and he really got angry. I'm filled to the ears with people complaining about this discrimination, that doesn't anybody trust anybody anymore, and then he backed off. But no, he ran a very good courtroom. He was highly respected. He was highly respected by all the lawyers that practiced before him. And as I say, most of the time, he had ruled against me. We had a sort of a, you know, case go before a judge court. But I'll tell you what he also did. He would give a clear shot. That is, he would give a clear ruling on the law. He would never obfuscate. He would never come up with technical things that might make an appeal differently. He would give a clear ruling, and that ruling would be taken up on appeal. I estimate that about half the time, he was affirmed, and half the time he was reversed. We had a fine relationship. I think he was just a wonderful judge.
And it sounds like you certainly praise him for handling the post-order plan. What was the, you know, it looked like he went through some rough times with the community. You know, something he basically disagreed with in the beginning. He was forced to see it through.
You know,
the
this
district
was
judge.
True of many judges in the southern states at an earlier time. You know, it was very hard. I'm talking now about in the 60s. You know, these are judges in places like Alabama and Georgia and Louisiana. They are part of the community, and they're in a community that was very hostile to desegregation, much more so than Louisville was. And again, Gordon was the federal judge. I mean, one of the reasons why these cases get litigated in federal courts is that the Constitution makes the federal judges independent. They have life tenure, and so they are not subject to political pressure the way that state court judges can't help but feel.
Right. Okay. What was the trial like? Let's go to the Louisville case, because it seemed to be larger. More people were probably opposing the suit there. There was more resistance. You know, what was that trial like? Was it did the Jefferson County and Louisville board members and staff?
You know, the cases were tried at a very high level. There were two very outstanding lawyers on the other side. John Fulton for Jefferson County. I know John is deceased, and you told me that Henry Triplett is still alive. These were fine lawyers. We got along very well together. They litigated the case in in accordance with proper standards. We put on a lot of statistical evidence. We put on evidence of how they were fixing boundaries in certain ways. But, you know, when I look back at it, and I do have, you know, the transcript, I don't know how much we were really disputing facts. So I don't have a lot of recollection about the actual testimony because they weren't as important to our case as statistics and undisputed facts.
It was just a question of how it was going to be handled.
Correct.
From talking to the other lawyers and the Newman Walker and some other people, and you, it sounds like there was a pretty civil relationship
yes.
amongst the legal minds and the administrators of this story, and even the judge.
Yes.
But what about board members and you know, NAACP activists? Was there any friction there in the courtroom or
no.
throughout the story?
No. Now, there were some different viewpoints. There was one person on the Louisville board who was later on the Jefferson County board. I don't know if you've interviewed Carolyn Hutto.
No, I don't. Say the name again.
Hutto, H-U-T-T-O.
Do not know her.
She, again, I have not seen her for, I think last time I saw her was at a banquet honoring Judge Gordon in 1989, so I don't know whether people are alive or well, but she is, again, someone that you might want to contact because she was the liberal board member who favored desegregation. And she can tell you a lot about the board people at the time.
She was on the city board or the county?
She was on the city board, and I believe after the merger, she was on the merge board.
Okay.
But in answer to your question, no, we did not have any contact with board members or super, except in the courtroom. And you know, because we didn't have any money, we didn't take depositions, or at least I don't have a recollection of taking much, but we essentially relied on what's called interrogatories, which is the best way to get the statistical information. But when we were, you know, questioning those people in court, it was largely cold. That would never happen today. There would be depositions, but that wasn't the case in 1973.
Okay, can you elaborate a little bit more about how the Kentucky Commission on Human Rights and Galen Martin and Tom Hogan, did you guys kind of become one team
once these suits were filed? We were one team as soon as we filed the suit.
And you were seeking, like, explain that, because
the first thing we had to do was to get a finding that both boards were in constitutional violation. It was only after we would get such a finding that we would be entitled to a remedy. Judge Gordon found that both boards were not in constitutional violation.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the main issue on appeal. The remedy was secondary.
And what kind of relationship did the two organizations have, the KCLU?
Very close. I mean, remember, you're back in the early 70s. As I like to put it, all the liberals knew each other.
Where was Susie Post in this story?
Susie Post, again, is a person that you should talk to. Susie was the president of the Kentucky Civil Liberties Union. Remember, we didn't have any money. We had a full-time executive secretary, later an executive director. Susie was the spirit of the ACLU. She was the one that got the organization heavily involved in things. She raised money. She recruited lawyers. She worked with different groups very effectively. She was the guiding force behind the Kentucky Civil Liberties Union, and she is the one who can tell you the most about the KCLU during that time.
So she was president. She was president, and you were lead counsel. Is that your title?
I was general counsel, and I was lead counsel. I was principal lawyer. That's true.
Okay.
When I say principal lawyer, I mean that was because I was a constitutional law professor. I did the law stuff, but on all the cases that I litigated, there were other lawyers working with me. As I said, Tom Hogan, who unfortunately is deceased, was the the principal litigating lawyer in the Louisville Jefferson County case. I mean, he was worked very closely with me, and after I took off and left, he handled the case during the difficult implementation time.
I see.
And you know, in the I showed you a draft of this article that I wrote about the case.
Right.
And I remember, and I ended with my remembrance of Tom, because shortly before he died, you know, Tom told me the story. It was said one of the an official of the former Louisville board said to him, "Do you really think you'll be happy with what you've done 10 years down the road?" And Tom had lived for only 9, but he said, "I'm very happy with what we've done," and that's, I think that sums up the feeling very much.
When Gordon overruled you, what was your anticipation of the Sixth Circuit? Go ahead.
I expected to win.
Did you explain how that worked back then? You got to go before a panel of 3, I guess, as today.
When you take an appeal, both sides file briefs. The appellant files the first brief. The appellee files a reply, response, and the appellant files a reply brief. You then have oral argument. I was pretty confident, you're never for sure, but I was optimistic that we would win because I truly believed that we had the law on our side in light of the Swan and Green opinions. And we did win the Sixth Circuit.
Did you know which judges would actually hear that?
No.
At some point, you find that out, I guess, right?
In those days, in those days, and up until fairly recently, you did not know who your appellate panel was. Now, we had 3 judges. I think I have Judge Wade McCree, who was from Detroit, whom I got to know very well after that. Judge McCree was the only African-American judge on the court. Judge William Miller from Tennessee, and Peck. It was Phillips, Judge Phillips from Tennessee. So we had 2 judges from Tennessee and 1 judge from Michigan on our panel.
The Michigan judge, can you tell me his name slowly?
His first name is Wade. His second name is McCree. McCree.
Okay. And you knew the record of these judges. You felt they were going to rule with you.
Well, again, this was at a time. Remember when? I mean, all of these judges. This is 19. So I'm pretty sure that they had been appointed by Democratic. I think they had all been appointed by Democratic presidents, or they had been appointed by Eisenhower, who was a moderate Republican. And the judges were not as ideological as judges are. Some were conservative, but again, I think that all 3 of them, both Phillips and Miller were judges who were very, very strong on racial equality, just like Max Winford was.
I see.
You know, I found in those days it was harder to win cases on gender equality, it was harder to win cases on abortion, it was harder to win cases on protest, but there certainly was a feeling among federal judges that we have to implement the Brown decision and implement a constitutional right to racial equality.
Are any of these judges still around?
No.
If one's trying to find out more about them,
I know passed away. I'm pretty sure that Judge Phillips and Judge Miller have also passed away. I'm not certain, but I'm pretty sure. And I know Judge Swinford passed away.
If I wanted to find more info on these 6th Circuit judges, where would you suggest looking?
The website.
Oh, this is the U.S. Court's website?
Yeah.
Okay.
But see, I know that none of them are, are seen. I'm pretty sure the others are deceased as well. But of course, you could Google them.
Right. Okay. So once that happened, the Supreme Court, there were, I'm a little confused on the nature of things after that. It went back to Gordon. He tried to work out a cross-district plan. Then the Milliken decision was decided two days later.
I understand that the school boards, Louisville and Jefferson County, still separate boards, had sought Supreme Court review of the Sixth Circuit decision of December 1973.
Why'd they do that?
Well, they wanted the Supreme Court to set those to reverse the Sixth Circuit, to rule that they were not illegally segregated, and to prohibit cross-district busing. Now, what happens with the court's practice is that when it has similar cases, mm-hmm. and it's hearing a case, it holds the other cases in back until it decides the main case. And so when the Supreme Court decided Detroit, this was in July of 1974, the very same day it issued an order granting the petitions for review in the Louisville and Jefferson County petitions, vacating the judgment of the Sixth Circuit, that was the December 1973 judgment, and remanding the cases back to the Sixth Circuit for reconsideration in light of Milliken.
So it still was in the power of the Sixth Circuit to make a call here, but it had to be within the scope of the Milliken decision.
So when the case was remanded, and we filed various motions to get the case advanced and so forth, we filed supplemental briefs, not on the illegal segregation, because that was not an issue anymore, but we filed supplemental briefs on the issue of cross-district busing. We argued that in October of 1974. And basically, in my brief, I argued that, unlike Milliken, we had two southern districts who were both in constitutional violation, that they had a history of a relationship, that during pre-Brown, as you may know or may not know, Jefferson County did not have a high school for black children, and it bused them all to Central High School in Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
We argued that under state law, Louisville was a sort of a grandparent district. That is, as of that time, all the districts were county districts, but Louisville, which had been a separate city district, could operate as a separate district. We also noted that school district lines did not follow city lines. And so with all those distinctions, the judges, who were the same judges and were sympathetic to us, ruled that under Milliken, an inter-district remedy was proper. At that point in time, the Louisville board made the strategic decision that it was going to abolish itself, which it did, I guess, around February of 1975. Now, it maintained a separate presence. So at that point, the issue of cross-district busing was pretty much over. The Jefferson County Board sought Supreme Court review, but it was denied. And so beginning in the spring of 1975, we worked on desegregation plans, Plan X, and so forth.
Okay, that helps me understand.
Now, one more point to understand. Judge Gordon took the position that he didn't want the plan to go into effect right away. Remember that?
Right, and you eventually agreed with him, didn't you?
Well, we debated that. I'll give you the history of that. The judge said, I want to delay this for a year. I said, Judge, with all due respect, you can't delay it for a year. You have to implement it right now. He says, well, that's why they have a court up in Cincinnati. I'm going to give a delay. Now, we have a legal procedure. It's an unusual one.
Mandamus.
It's known as a writ of mandamus. And you can only get it by showing that the lower court judge issued a breach a non-discretionary duty. Anyhow,
all right. So the busing order, the merger, the school year is going to open up on September 4th, 1975, and quite a bit of violence and protest followed.
Remember, I was gone.
When did you actually leave Kentucky?
We finished up the approval of the plan the end of July.
So you left right before school started, pretty much.
We left sometime in August.
Now, what did you expect any of this violence and protest
no,
in the community in Louisville?
No, I did not expect it.
What did you think about it?
Again, I was surprised. I was in Italy. I did a sabbatical in Italy. Tom Hogan sent some communication to me. I saw it in Newsweek International. But in all honesty, I was not involved at all.
Well, what was your take? I mean, I know you were gone, but, I mean...
It was pretty much... Tom and the people there will take care of it. At the time, to be honest, the idea of a sabbatical was to get away from things. I had delayed a sabbatical because I was doing this case and other things, and I just wanted to get away. I wanted to do some thinking about what I was going to do. I wanted to do some research in my other field. And so, I didn't pay much attention to it.
Did you feel any responsibility up for it?
No. I mean, we did the right thing. The people who were engaged in violence did the wrong thing. The local authorities and Judge Gordon and the governor did the right thing. And, the plan went into effect, and we knew that in time opposition would cease, which it did.
I see. Now, were there any other, that's the bulk of my questions, but were there any other suits that you filed that we should discuss here?
Those were the major suits in Kentucky. Now, there was another case that Tom did along with Bob Delahanty, and I think Bob has passed away. It was in Hopkinsville.
And who should I talk to about that?
Galen Martin might know. As I say, the two lawyers are both dead.
Okay.
But that was a fairly minor thing. This was, as I say, the main things in Louisville in Kentucky in the 70s were Louisville and Lexington. The other areas, with the exception of Hopkins, had a pretty small black population, and they were integrated. You got to remember, I know what the figures are today, but in 1972, the African American population of the state of Kentucky was only 7%.
Mm-hmm.